This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. When Sweden started their Vision Zero initiative, about 7 in 100,000 residents died each year in traffic accidents. After about a decade and a half, that number is now less than 3. So what has Sweden done to make streets safer? That's what New York Mayor Bill de Blasio wondered. Now he's trying his own Vision Zero to make city streets safer in New York. It's just one of a few stories that we'll talk about today as we consider building better roads. Later, we'll talk to a civil engineer who's running into criticism for voicing his opinions about our highway building culture, and we'll consider a plan that many of us might think about during these frigid winter months. Yes, what if you could strap on some ice skates and glide to work? Joining us in studio is Norm Garrick. He's associate professor of civil and environmental engineering at the University of Connecticut and frequently our guide down a better roadway system. Norm Garrick, welcome to our program once again.
Thank you, John. Good morning.
And joining us on the phone from Sweden is Mats Berlin, who's a project manager at the Vision Zero Academy, which is part of the Swedish Transport Administration. And Dr. Berlin, welcome to our program. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm wondering if you could first give us a little background. Where did the idea for Vision Zero come from?
Well, Sweden has, from a historic perspective, been quite successful in safety. In the 70s, the number of fatalities dropped very dramatically. But in the 80s, the numbers start to grow again. And in the beginning of the 90s, it dropped very dramatically again. And I wish it was because of a fantastic road safety work, but that was not the case. It was because of a deep economic recession in our society. And as an experts, we knew that when the wheel start to roll again, we were in a problem. We needed to find new innovations. We needed to change our policies more dramatically. And that was when we came up with its idea about Vision Zero.
So explain some of the tenets of Vision Zero and how they differ perhaps from some of the traditional ideas surrounding roadway safety.
Yeah, the first thing, and I think that's probably one of the things that triggers some of other countries in jurisdiction around the world now, it's that Vision Zero is based on an ethical imperative that it can never be accepted that people are killed or serious injury when moving with a transport system. So that's the main thing. But I will also say that Vision Zero as a policy is a policy innovation. It's something quite different from a traditional way of working with road safety. If you take a traditional approach, the problem that you try to solve is the problem with accidents. And we know when we do in-depth studies and that sort of thing that it's 90% of all accidents is due to human factors. So therefore, we have put the most responsibility on the individual road user. But Vision Zero, the problem is not per se accidents. The problem that we try to solve is a problem that people get killed and serious injuries. And the reason why people get killed and serious injuries is because the system is not designed according to humans and because humans make mistakes. And when something happens, we have a certain tolerance against external violence. And that is the main parameters that we try to design our road transport system from a Vision Zero point of view.
And of course, please continue. I just wanted to say that for many American listeners, we think about how we might design better roadways, and we'll talk a little bit more about the design pieces of this. But the real key piece that you just described that I'd like to have you just flesh out a little bit more for us is this difference between individual responsibility versus a collective responsibility for safety. This is, in some ways, Mats, a very different than the American ideal of individualism. And so it may take a little bit more explanation for our listeners.
Yeah. So yeah, it's true, and if I take a very concrete example, if you have a typical four-lane intersection, the way that we try to solve the safety problem in that intersection is to put up a traffic light, and yes, the accident will probably decrease if we put up this traffic light, but we will still have crashes. And the typical scenario is someone driving against red light and right into a car, and then you have a fatal or serious injury due to the high-speed crash. But in Vision Zero, the solution it will be more roundabout. And roundabouts probably increase the number of accidents, but those who will happen will be less severe. And a traffic light and a roundabout might actually be the difference between a life and death. And that is nothing that we as individual road users decide about. It's a designer of the system who make that kind of decisions. Therefore, in Vision Zero, the primary responsibility is actually on us as system designer, the traffic engineers or others. They have the primary responsibility according to Vision Zero.
I'd love to get some thoughts from Norm Garrick as you hear some of what Mats Berlin talks about. I think the design pieces of it, and we've certainly talked about designing roadways for roundabouts versus 90-degree intersections in the past, but there is something very different, Norm, about what he's talking about this collective responsibility. I guess I'm wondering what your reaction to that is as a designer here in America of roadway systems.
Well, there are lots of different pieces to this. One of the things I looked at that Mats put out was a graph showing the change in attitude towards speed in highway design. And he has a graph showing the change from 1970s to now. And the approach that they showed in Sweden in 1970s is basically the approach that we are using now in the U.S. So that change in attitude is something that we really have not caught up with here in terms of how we teach design and how we practice design.
Well, when you talk about speed, tell me a bit more about that. I mean, how does speed, Norm, factor into all this?
Well, in the U.S., we design so that people can go as fast as they desire. That's the idea, is that we should allow people to go their desired speed. The change in Sweden and other places in Europe, such as the Netherlands, is that we need to design for safety. We need to design for the context. So, for example, in a built-up urban area where you have pedestrians, bikers, etc., you need to design in such a way that you're telegraphing to the driver that they need to take more care, they need to go slower.
I'm wondering, Dr. Berlin, if you can talk about that idea of speed. There is this American ideal that we should be able to drive essentially as fast as we want to, but that's not just an American ideal. We just got a tweet from Brendan, one of our listeners, who says, I think we should learn from the Autobahn and generally abolish speed limits. So talk about how Sweden has addressed from a design perspective the idea of people going the right miles per hour in order to reduce traffic fatalities.
No, it's true, because in Vision Zero, the reason why people get killed in serious injury, as I said, is that we have some tolerance against external violence. So we know quite much now about how much speed we can tolerate. If you have, for example, an urban area and you have a crash with a car and an unprotected road user in 50 kilometers, the risk that you get killed in that crash will be more than 80%. But if you get hit in less than 30 kilometers, the risk is less than 10%. And this kind of scientific evidence, now we try to build into our policies. So therefore, when we're talking about speed limits in urban area, where we plan to have conflict between pedestrians and cyclists and so on, we need to make sure that the speed is not higher than 30 kilometers. But we also know that a modern car could not have an head-on collision in higher speed than, let's say, 80 kilometers. So therefore, in Sweden now, if we have a road where we risk to have a head-on collision, we don't have higher speed at 80 kilometers. But if we want higher speed, we need to protect the driver. drivers from head-on collision. So the speed and the design of the roads go together in a policy like Vision Zero.
We're talking today with Mats Berlin, who's project manager at the Vision Zero Academy, part of the Swedish Transport Administration. They have undergone a really remarkable program over the course of the last decade and a half or so to reduce traffic fatalities, and they have cut the number of traffic fatalities in what was already a very safe country more than in half. We're trying to learn a little bit here in Connecticut as we design our own transportation systems. Norm Garrick joins us in studio. He's an associate professor of civil and environmental engineering at the University of Connecticut. I'm wondering, before I let you go, Dr. Berlin, are there some other ideas, maybe even simple design ideas, that American designers, American lawmakers listening to our program might want to think about when they consider how to rebuild our highways?
Well, just to add another perspective on this vision, so because it's not just the road design and that sort of thing. It's also our mindset when it comes to typical problem behaviors, so to say. If you take, for example, drink and driving. Drink and driving, if you go out in the traffic in Sweden, you will only find 2 per 1,000 that are influenced by alcohol. But if you go into the death statistics, you will find 15-20%. So we don't have a social norm problem with drink and driving, but we still have a safety problem with drink and driving. And we go so long now in Sweden that to say that drink and driving is not just a problem for the individual road users now. It's a system design problem. So we are now developing much more technology for kind of devices to prevent people from drinking driving, alcohol and that sort of thing, because we think that that is in the long run the sustainable solution of this problem, to have a alcohol device as we have a seatbelt in the car, for example. So it's a very holistic kind of policy that we try to solve different safety problems.
Norm Garrick, talk a little bit more about how what he's talking about is different than what is maybe taught in American engineering schools or what is thought of in American departments of transportation. This idea that people will make mistakes, that a certain percentage of people will drink and drive, that a certain number of people will turn the wrong way at an intersection in a city and maybe hit a pedestrian. Those are things that Sweden seems to be saying, we accept and acknowledge the statistics. We're going to try to design around that. How much different, Norm, is that thinking than the thinking that goes into construction of transportation systems in America?
Well, what is different is the mindset that accidents are unacceptable. We have been doing a lot of research at UConn comparing the U.S. to the experience in OECD countries that are at the same level of economic development. And we have been shocked by the numbers, frankly, about not just the fact that we are now worse than any of these countries, but the extent to which we are diverging. And one of the things that we seem to be run upon against is the fact that it's almost taken for granted that people are going to die in car accidents here. And what Dr. Berlin is talking about is a mindset that this is unacceptable. We have not gotten to that stage. I've also looked a lot at the experience in the Netherlands. The Netherlands had almost as many traffic fatalities per capita as we did back in the 70s. And they have come down tremendously, even more so than Sweden. Part of what happened there was a reaction to what they called child murder by car. And so this was a public-driven reaction to what was going on the roads, and the engineers responded. We have not seen anything like that here. We still accept that 100 people will die, and that's fine, it seems, in some ways.
Another reality of, say, the Netherlands in the urban areas is there's a bicycle culture. There's a culture in which the car isn't necessarily the primary mode of transportation for people, Norm.
Yes, that's true. But again, this is tied to what happened in the 70s, because the government was on a kick to increase car use and to push out bikes out of the city. And what people saw was not just that they were losing city space, etc., but also the toll from traffic fatalities. One of the interesting things about places like the Netherlands and Sweden is that bikers and pedestrians are considered to be vulnerable road users. So when you have a lot of bikers and pedestrians around, you expect more fatalities. And that's not what you see in places that have actually facilitated, places like Portland, Oregon, and New York now, that are facilitating more bike and pedestrian use. Because to get more bike and pedestrian use, you have to make the roads seem safer and be safer for these users.
I want to get to a quick phone call, a question here from Jeff in Prospect. Hi there, Jeff. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Couple questions. One, we've talked about Sweden's rate of death reducing from 7 per 1,000 to 3 per 1,000, which seems like a great improvement. What is the United States currently, and is there a difference in density? Even though we're talking about per capita, does the United States have a greater density of traffic in the country?
Two great questions, Jeff. I think I can answer the first question, which is the American rate most recently is, I think, something like 11.6 per 100,000. So that's essentially double thereabouts what Sweden was some 10 years ago, and quite a bit more than the number that they have right now. Dr. Baleen, I'm wondering if you can answer the second part of Jeff's question about density of the urban areas.
Yeah, of course, countries is very different, and Sweden is more a rural area, and so it's a very sometimes very difficult to compare different countries, and that's why also we're using these kind of risk measures where fatalities per 100,000 inhabitants and that sort of so on. So sometimes it's different, yeah.
Well, I could give a perspective on that, in that the countries that are doing better than us are countries of all different types. For example, Australia is doing quite well. Canada is doing better. Germany, Switzerland, the Netherlands, they are all very different countries. And Japan, they're all doing well. But places like Italy and France are not doing that well. So it's not just a question of necessarily density or urban form, et cetera.
Is there something, Norm, for those of us who maybe have traveled to places like Italy and France that maybe is substantially different about the roadways or roadway construction that we might understand is different from America or different from the Netherlands?
It's really hard to get data to compare, but it seems to us that it's more in the attitude towards design that we have in the different countries. That's one of the things that we really need to do is to really dig into what is going on, say, in the Netherlands versus Belgium. We have seen in our data a divergence in the Belgium is getting worse, the Netherlands is getting better, and they're very, very similar countries. But we know that the Netherlands has a very, very holistic and very forward-looking approach to street design.
My sense from driving on some windy roads in Italy is they don't really care if you drive off the road to your death in many places in that country. I want to thank very much Mats Baleen, who's the project manager at the Vision Zero Academy. Some of these ideas are coming to the States, including places like New York City. Dr. Baleen, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
When we come back, we're going to continue our conversation about building better roads, and we're going to bring into the conversation someone who's been criticized within his field for talking about the transportation system that we have today, the way in which we build highways. If you want to join us, Where We Live at WNPR.org. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today in the program, we're talking about building better roads. Governor Malloy has said that he wants to invest in infrastructure and transportation in the state. We're talking about rails. We're talking about busways. We're talking about maybe widening highways. Some people think some of those ideas are really good ideas. Some people think we should spend our money elsewhere. Our guide through this world of transportation, as always, is Norm Garrick. He's Associate Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of Connecticut. Joining us by phone is Charles Marone, who's president and co-founder of the nonprofit Strong Towns. Charles Marone is a civil engineer, someone who's taken some criticism from within his world for some of the way he's talked about the highway building culture that we have here in the United States. And Charles, welcome to our program. Thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
I'm wondering, first of all, you can talk a little bit about some of the criticisms you have about what we do right now to build roads. Obviously, we have departments of transportation all over the country that are invested in building bigger, better roadway systems, while we also try to spend money on public transit and other things. What is your basic take on our highway culture here in America?
Well, I would make a distinguish between roads and streets, and that's kind of a foundational thing here for us at Strong Towns. We talk about them as if they're interchangeable, and they're really not. Roadways connect places. They connect places across long distances, and in the United States, we're brilliant at this. I mean, we do it better than I think anyone in the world. We build fantastic highways. They're generally high-performing places, and I have no critique at all with our highway system. The place where we fall down is in our streets, and we describe streets as the platforms that we use to create value in our places. These are the infrastructure that you have in front of your house, in front of your business. It's the first and last mile of each trip. And what we've done in the United States is we've taken our great successes that we've had in building roadways, and we've tried to apply that knowledge just in rote force to our streets. And they're fundamentally different places, and they need a fundamentally different type of design.
Well, give us an example of the difference in design that is needed, and maybe the differences that you've seen in the actual building of streets over the course of time.
I think that's a perfect question. When we build a highway, we employ techniques called forgiving design. The idea is that we want to forgive the mistake that the driver makes. And so we have extra wide lanes in case they, you know, venture over a little bit. They've got a little recovery room. We put in wide shoulders. We put in wide recovery zones. When we bring those things into urban areas and we put those on the streets, we clear out the trees, we put in wide lanes, what we do is we are encouraging speeds that are above and beyond what are safe in neighborhoods. Cities are very complex places. If you just look at cars, cars stop, they turn, they do all kinds of things that you don't have on a highway. In cities, you have people. You have people walking, you have people on bikes and wheelchairs, people, you know, kids run out into the street when their ball is knocked out of the yard. There's all kinds of things that happen. And when we design with a mindset that forgives the driver, what we fail to do in urban areas is forgive everybody else. And that's really where we've suffered over the last few decades.
It's interesting. As you describe that, I'm picturing a walk in New York City that I often take that has me crossing four lanes heading in one direction on a Park Avenue or a Fifth Avenue, and you see the lights turn green a half a block away, and you have to rush across because you know that there's going to be this enormous cavalcade of traffic, of buses and cars and taxis all flying at you at top speed, and the pedestrians have to get out of the way. And that's even in one of the places that as Bill de Blasio is trying to do, New York City, that is trying to be made a little bit safer for the pedestrians. So what do we do to change this mindset about how we build our streets like highways all the time, Charles?
Well, I think one of the things that we have to acknowledge is that we're going broke doing this. We're literally bankrupting our cities with this approach. Whenever we design for automobiles, we spend a lot of money, and the resulting development that we get is really low in terms of financial productivity. The amount of tax base, the amount of wealth generated per acre is really, really low. And it's simply because we're spreading everything apart. I mean, when you build sidewalks and pipe and what have you, I'm an engineer. When you build this by the foot, it's a lot more expensive to spread everything out, right? So our cities need to acknowledge that they're going broke. And I think once we do that, we can start to look and see, all right, where are our places in our cities that are the financially best, they're the most productive. And we've modeled this in dozens of places around the country. They're always the places with the greatest amount of walkability, the places that are most friendly towards people outside of cars. They're the places that elevate humans over automobile movement. And, you know, I think if we start with that and retask our engineers to building value instead of just moving cars, we can start to do some amazing things with a lot less money.
We're talking with Charles Marone, who's president and co-founder of the nonprofit Strong Towns. Norm Garrick is here with us from the University of Connecticut. I'd like some thoughts from you, Norm, on this.
I think Charles has made some really important points. For example, this issue of how we think about highways versus streets, it is true that conceptually we think of them as the same thing in terms of how a lot of places teach highway design. So a lot of the problems, like even the street, Asylum Street here, is more like a highway than a city street. So it doesn't support the neighborhood. It doesn't make the neighborhood feel as a place you would necessarily want to be walking on, etc. So that's one really very important point, and that ties back to this issue of value. How do we value a city like Hartford? Is it just a place where we want to get people out as quickly as possible to get to the Farmington Valley? So a city needs to consider where its value lies, what's important to make it function as a place, rather than just a place where people are coming in or out.
Well, okay, so I'll actually put something on the table for you first, Norm, and then Charles, I'd like you to jump in. One of the things that adds value to a community is the ability to be able to get where you want to go as quickly as is reasonable and safely as well. In some roadway systems, street systems like the one here, you mentioned Asylum Avenue right outside our building acts a lot like a highway. Yesterday, we had an accident along the street, and it was a bad accident. It wasn't a terrible accident. It was bad enough to have caused a massive traffic jam all over this part of town. So I'm wondering, Norm, if you could just talk about that one piece of value to us is traffic congestion, and how all of the things that we've talked about so far can help to deal with this one problem of we want to be able to get someplace quickly and safely, but we don't want to have these problems of every fifth day sitting in traffic for 45 minutes that we don't want.
So the misunderstanding is the idea that we need to get places quickly to move quickly to get places. In cities, one of the value of cities is that things are close together. So you can walk, you can bike, so you don't need to be moving as quickly. What we have done in Hartford is basically cleared out half of the city so that we end up with a situation where you don't want to walk or bike in the city. And also we have made it easy to move fast. So there is this fundamental misconception about what is important in cities and how transportation feeds into that. And I think that's what's going on in Hartford. There's nobody walking on Asylum Avenue. I'm sure 50, 60, 70 years ago, it was a very, very different place. And the city was a very different functioning place and a very different economic engine in the metropolitan area.
Yeah, I'm getting waved at through the glass. Kyone Wolf, our producer, does walk in this neighborhood because it's her neighborhood and there's no crosswalks. It's very hard to get across the street. Charles Murren, I'm wondering if you can jump in on that part.
Yeah, I think it gets back to the road and street conversation. I think your supposition holds completely when we're talking about distance between places, right? If you're traveling over long distance, 20 miles, 10 miles even, you want to be able to move at high speed, and that high speed is going to affect your ability to have value in that trip. Congestion ruins that. But when we're talking about within cities, the actual value is created by the proximity of the places to you. And the value, as we measure it in tax base and wealth and opportunity, are all inversely proportional to speed. What we have found is that if you actually took a city and said, instead of having 30-mile-an-hour speed, we're going to have 15-mile-an-hour speed, people get all bent out of shape, right? Oh, my gosh, we can't go that slow. We won't get anywhere. Well, your average speed in a city is around 11 to 12 miles an hour anyway, because you have to stop at traffic signals. You've got to wait because we've got this system of priority we set up that is kind of descended from the highway system. We've seen places where they have actually eliminated signals, reduced the speed so that people are driving at a really, really slow speed, slow enough where people feel comfortable to walk out in traffic. At the intersections, you kind of make your way through like you would in a parking lot where you have low speeds. And voila, people actually have lower travel times. They actually get to where they're going faster because they're not impaired at the junction, at the intersection, and they're having to sit at that traffic signal.
What you're talking about, though, gets back to the earlier part of our conversation with Mats Berlin in Sweden, which is looking at the city or any municipality as a type of system in which the overall goal is to get everyone moving where they need to move, not making it as easy for any individual to get where he wants to go as fast as possible. And that really is a mindset change, Charles, I think, as much as a design change.
If I had to critique one, put my finger on one thing that we've really messed up with American cities is we've made them all about engineers moving cars. And the reality is a lot of our problems are land use problems. How are we building this street? What are the actual buildings like? How do they front the street? What are the size of them, and what implications are that for the economic opportunities for different business styles and different business types, different affordable housing options? These are all things that we today try to solve through transportation policy, and we have to acknowledge that it's far more complex than that.
And Norm, I know this is something you and I have talked about. Do you have a thought on that?
Yes, and I was just thinking about the locked box that we're talking about for transportation funds. Every time I hear that term, I cringe because transportation is not divorced from the larger society. So why should we dedicate funds just to building stuff when it's about the land use, it's about all kinds of health issues? We need to have a more holistic view of transportation and its impact on society and cities, et cetera.
But that's about government design more than about roadway design or anything else. That's about how we design government. We all have departments of transportation which need to be fed with money, right?
Exactly. But the two things are interrelated. How we design government is how we think about these different facilities. We think about them as being separate. So we fix the transportation and everything is fine, but we're not considering the land use. So it actually doesn't work. And this is over and over the problem that we face in Connecticut.
Well, speaking of government, in just the last few minutes that we have, Charles, I want to put this to you first. It's something we've talked about a little bit, and it's something we're going to be hearing from our governor, Dan Malloy, about in his budget address coming up in a few weeks. He's saying that we need to make massive transportation infrastructure investments in the state. I don't think anybody is disagreeing with that. We have crumbling bridges that need to be fixed. We've got a high-speed rail system that we're trying to get off the ground. We've got a Metro North system that we certainly have seen has had a lot of accident problems over the course of the last couple of years, and he wants to invest in the state. One of the things he said, though, Charles, is he has a vision for widening I-95, essentially for taking this corridor, which has people traveling from New York up to Boston through our state of Connecticut along the shoreline, making a little bit wider so as to make it safer, so as to make it less congested. Charles, I've talked to an awful lot of engineers on these issues over time. I've never heard one say that making a roadway wider is going to solve a problem of congestion, but I'm not the expert here. You are. What do you say?
Well, we will not solve congestion by making roadways wider. There's a saying that has cropped up that I think is really good. Trying to solve congestion by making the road wider is like trying to solve obesity by buying bigger pants, right? You're not really getting at the fundamental problem that's going on. And it really isn't. I think at the end of the day, the important thing to understand about congestion, for the most part, is it's not a supply and demand problem the way we generally think about it. We're not. It's more of a tragedy of the commons almost problem, because we're not allocating the stuff based on any type of supply and demand signal. Everybody wants their commute at a certain time, a certain place, and they have an anticipation of a certain traffic flow level. We in this country have resisted efforts to price this stuff in a way that would give a good market signal, a good feedback signal. And I think that's one of the things that's on the table in some states that Connecticut should be talking about as well.
Norm, I'd love your thoughts on this, to Governor Malloy's proposal and some of what you just heard from Charles.
Well, in general, what Charles said is correct, but there are places that have solved congestion by widening and building more and more roads, and we can look at Detroit, And there are places that we do not want to emulate because what they've done is kill the economic vitality and life in the
place.
Well,
some other things help to kill Detroit's economic vitality as well. I mean, let's just be fair.
No, that's true.
Yeah.
But we should not underestimate what was done to that city from a transportation point of view. It's disastrous when we look at cities around the country that went the way of Detroit. It was not just about a collapse in car industry or anything of that sort.
Well, but and just while I have you for a couple of minutes, both of you, this is really interesting. What I'm taking away from this conversation is that while we think of transportation as an engineering issue, it seems in many ways like a psychology issue. It's an economics issue. And I'm wondering, Norm, if there is a way for the field that you're in and that Charles is in to integrate more some of these ideas for the young people who are coming up in the field that you are to be thinking more on the psychology that Sweden is using, a little bit more of the collective ideals that they're talking about. That's maybe a different way of thinking about building roads and bridges, right?
Yes. Transportation is not really an engineering field, and that's part of the problem that we are forced with. And so at UConn, we are really trying hard to get across the idea that it's really interdisciplinary, and we're trying to work in an interdisciplinary way. I work a lot with colleagues in landscape architecture, in geography, in economics, and we are trying to train our students in that multidisciplinary perspective.
And I know, Charles, you have some strong thoughts about your profession as well. I'll give you the last word on this.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely on the right track. I do have a lot of faith in a lot of the younger people coming up because they've lived in a more complex world, particularly when it comes to the communications and the internet. And I think they get some of the feedback loops that maybe weren't apparent 50, 60 years ago when we just started out doing this stuff. So I'm optimistic that some of those complexity science things, the behavioral science, the evolutionary biology, there's a lot of fascinating things where they're pushing the boundaries. I'm excited to see some of that thought creeping in, and I'm optimistic that that will become more and more part of the conversation, which it absolutely has to.
Charles Marone is president and co-founder of the nonprofit Strong Towns. Thanks so much for joining us, Charles. I appreciate it.
Hey, thank you. It's a great opportunity.
When we come back, we've heard a lot about busways or bikeways, walkways, different ways to get people where they need to go. What about a skateway? It's something they're talking about in Edmonton, Alberta. That's coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking about building better roads, better ways of getting us where we need to go with Norm Garrick. He's Associate Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of Connecticut. Our next conversation is actually something I was thinking about a lot this morning. I woke up in my home in Winsted, Connecticut. My driveway is completely iced over, and I started to slip down the driveway, and I thought, maybe I can just skate all the way to work. It's all frozen. Well, Matt Gibbs, designer of the Edmonton Freeway, has that exact idea. In Alberta, they're thinking about building a roadway that you can actually skate to work on. Matt Gibbs, welcome to Where We Live.
Thanks for having me.
So explain this idea. What is it? What's the freeway?
Well, my idea for the freeway was looking at how we could shift that paradigm of what it would take to get people out of their cars and taking more active means to get to their destinations, taking their errands, and as well promoting recreation. And the idea was that we could take some bike lanes in the city, and in the city of Edmonton, where we spend on average 5 months a year below freezing, I wanted to look at if we could potentially create this bike lane that could be frozen in the winter to create this network throughout the city that could be complemented by light displays to help get people outdoors and active in that very sedentary time of year.
Well, and it is a sedentary time of year, I know full well, and it would be nice to be able to get out and skate. Is this something that's been tried anywhere else? I mean, I know that in Canada, there's a lot of places where the canals freeze and you can go out and skate for fun, but is this something that's ever been tried before?
Well, the difference with my proposal is that it could take place on the city and not on a water body. In the city of Ottawa, there's already a canal there that people use to skate to their desk at work or the university. And that gets over 1 million visits a year. as well in the Forks in Winnipeg, they've built a 9-kilometer skating trail. So that's where my conversion there is, about a 5-mile skating trail. And that gets over 250,000 visitors a year, skaters per year. And so a lot of people are taking advantage of these opportunities. And in the city of Edmonton, they're undergoing a massive revitalization. And I wanted to look at how we could do things a little differently and challenge that status quo in one of the most auto-dependent cities we have in Canada.
An auto-dependent city. Tell us a little bit more about that. You're really trying to get people out of their cars, and it's been a struggle in Edmonton?
Well, yeah, it's definitely the way the city was built. And I wanted to look at how the city could meet its goals of diversifying transportation choices as well as diversifying housing types and help them enable their goals of attracting young professionals to the city by creating these walkable, tight-knit communities where you don't have long trips to outside, particularly when the weather is uncomfortable. In my opinion, I found that in the different cities I've lived in, it's a lot easier to enjoy bad weather when you have short destinations between your spaces. And so that requires a lot of planning. But luckily, I found a route in the city of Edmonton that skirts the edge of the north end of its city core, and that could be complemented by two former railroad right-of-ways that are relatively unused spaces that extend towards the downtown core that, if combined, could create a 7-mile segment that could create this comprehensive greenway that could be this, you know, one-of-a-kind tourist attraction, allowing people to skate to work, to school, or the hockey game.
Skating to the hockey game. Norm Garrick, what do you think about this? I mean, yes, in Connecticut, it feels like our winter goes on forever. Maybe we don't have enough cold days to actually have a freezeway, but what do you think of this idea in Edmonton?
This is a great idea. I would like to actually go visit. But this is an example of the ideas that are possible when we don't equate good transportation to high-speed transportation. We can start to think of different ways of connecting people and things. So we're seeing all over the world, we're seeing things like ferries that are now being used again. They often cut down the distance between places. They're slow-moving, but they're really efficient at connectivity. We are seeing cable cars in a lot of Latin American cities connecting the favelas and the barrios to the downtowns. So these are ideas that we had gone away from all over the world, and we're getting back to streetcars are also another idea I would put in this pot, where it's a slow method of transportation, but it's about connections, it's about access, it's about the city.
Well, Matt Gibbs, so tell us about where the plan is right now. I mean, are you getting support for this? Is this something that you need a lot of funding for? What happens next?
Well, I've been looking for a lot of people are really excited about this, and for the first time in my life, I've heard a lot of people say, oh, man, I would love to go to Edmonton for that. And so I think there's a lot of possibility there. I think a lot of people are having a hard time wrapping their head around it. I have found a site where people are interested in working with me to help develop a pilot project, but it won't necessarily be on the route that we've proposed. So I think the first step is getting people to see the potential for an opportunity like this, getting them to see what kind of an exciting opportunity it would be to have a skating trail that could be complemented by all these different exciting spaces lined with patios that really could really fuel the excitement going on in this space. And currently, it's just an idea about how we could look at making a different city for future generations.
Well, we wish you the best of luck with this, Matt Gibbs. And Norm and I will come and visit if you end up building your freezeway. We'd love to come up and skate to the hockey game with you. Thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
Matt Gibbs is designer of the Edmonton Freezeway Project. In just the last couple minutes that we have, Norm Garrick, you know, we have talked a lot about some big ideas and some very, very small ideas. Do you have a sense in some of the conversations that you have that we are moving as a state towards some of these smaller, slower ideas, these connectivity ideas in urban and even suburban areas that I know you've been talking about for years? Are we getting there?
We're moving in Connecticut, but not as fast as many other places around the country. And that's a disappointment for me. We are, we have moved so far in understanding that it's not just about cars, but we've still not gotten to where we understand the transportation, urban planning, land use, vitality connection. So we're not seeing the smaller moves that would make cities function better. And that's, I think, is the next stage that we need.
But one of the questions always is, where does that vitality come from? In some of the conversations we've had in the past about, say, streetcar lines, you can get private investment to build up around a corridor, but first you have to have the initial investment to say we want to build a streetcar along that corridor. It's the old chicken and egg problem. I mean, where does the impetus come from for some of this vitality?
A lot of it comes from people having a vision of how changes can occur. Yes, you need to have initial investment, but there are projects in the country now where they are looking at the potential for future growth, and so developing financial approaches that bring monies up front, like bonding, so that you can have the money for the initial investment, and then over time the investment is paid for by land use changes. So, for example, one example of that is the streetcar in Portland, Oregon, which was built without any federal funds. So they didn't have to wait 15 years to get their project out of the road like we are doing with the busway.
And that's it. Waiting for federal funds is sometimes one of the problems. We just have 1 minute left. I guess one of the big issues that we started with is Governor Malloy says transportation is going to be his focus this coming session. If you have a chance to talk to Governor Malloy and say, here's one thing you need to focus on, if you're going to spend the state money, what is it you tell him?
I think we need to look at how transportation affects our cities. That's by far the most important problem with transportation in the state. Is not necessarily about congestion, which is very visible and gets a lot of attention. But what we have done in transportation has damaged severely our cities, and we really need to start reversing this issue. This is what is happening in a lot of places. We look to Washington, D.C. We look to Portland. We look to Cambridge. We can see how they've gone about repairing the cities. And that's, I think that should be a state mandate.
And it started in New Haven. I mean, the dismantling of this 34 connector, something that tore apart the city some decades ago, now it's starting to change once again, seemingly in the right direction.
New Haven is the shining light in terms of what we can get done. It has a long way to go, but it's the right direction.
Norm Garrick from the University of Connecticut, always our guide in transportation issues. Thank you so much, Norm. It's good to see you.
Thank you.
Our show is produced by Lydia Brown, Tucker Ives, Betsy Kaplan, and Kyone Wolf. Our digital editor is Heather Brandon. Our executive producer is Katie Talarski. Our intern today, Kelsey Bissell. You can continue this conversation on our website, WNPR.org. This is Where We Live.